Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today, we're going to welcome back John Barber. John Barber is quite the raconteur, and he is an actor, comedian, and television host known as one of the hosts of the reality television series, Real People. And John, as in that capacity, in his time with Real People, he went to New Orleans to interview Jim Garrison, who was featured in Oliver Stone's film about the Kennedy assassination. And John just recently released a new documentary, John Barber, called John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Tapes, which is about that three-hour interview that John Barber did with Jim Garrison, attorney Jim Garrison. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with my guest, John Barber. John Barber, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Oh, Cindy, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate, first of all, you. I appreciate being back on your show, but this accidental timing of being with you on November 22nd, which is the 53rd anniversary of the murder of John Kennedy.
Right.
And, you know, I started out, Cindy, as a comic, and Red Fox was my mentor, believe it or not. And Red had a wonderful line in his act. He said, "Heroes ain't born, they're cornered." Well, you know,
yeah.
Jim Garrison happened to be cornered by accidentally having to read the Warren Report, which was published in 1964. And when it was first published, he believed it. But strangely enough, almost everything wonderful that has happened to me, Cindy, in my life, has been by accident. And I used to do a thing in my act, believe it or not, about how the best things in our lives always happen by accident, but the worst disasters are those things that are well planned.
Exactly.
Like the EDSA was well planned, the Vietnam War was well planned, but it was only accidental they caught crooks at the Watergate Hotel. And, you know, I am not in the least bit religious. As a matter of fact, Cindy, I don't know anybody who's truly religious who is not somehow prejudiced, but I've never met anybody who was spiritual who was prejudiced.
Right.
And I am not above, though, enjoying wonderful religious music or religious art. And one of my very favorite quotations is from an unknown Civil War soldier who said, "I never got from God anything I prayed for, but I got everything in life that I needed."
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of happened to me, especially when it came to this story. And when I talk about the wonderful things happening by accident, it was an accident that Real People got on the air. It was an accident that I started the AM show in Los Angeles for the first time. I got to talk to Mr. Garrison and try to book him. And it was an absolute total accident that I got the money. I'll tell you that story later, and it is truly kind of metaphysical, to do the original Garrison tapes. And then it was an accident that today people will be able to see the story about the fellow, meaning me, who tried to tell and is still trying to tell Jim Garrison's story. So if you'd like to know how that came about, I would be happy to tell you.
Yes, yep. We would love to know how that came about, but I think we need to backtrack a little bit because the subject of the documentary that you're talking about, the film that you're talking about, is the last word on the
On the Garrison.
Garrison tapes, right?
That's
And
right.
so I had you on, I don't even know exactly when you were on, but we talked about your very, you know, deep career, and we talked about how it came about that you interviewed Jim Garrison, who was the only person that actually brought anything about the Kennedy assassination to trial. And, you know, we talked about all those kinds of things, but we didn't get really into too deeply about the substance of your interview with Garrison, because I believe you talked to him for, like, if I remember correctly, like 3 hours or something like that.
It was absolutely 3 hours. It was three of the most thrilling, exciting, terrifying, interesting American 3 hours that I'd ever spent in my life. And you know, sometimes, Cindy, somebody will say, if you doubt somebody sometimes they will say something to you that rings a bell.
Mm-hmm.
And after the interview, I said to Mr. Garrison, I said, Mr. Garrison, you know, you were an FBI agent. You were in the military. You're neither a conservative or a liberal. You're neither a Republican or a Democrat. You're a true independent, I said, and you're still in the reserves, as it were. How on earth, when you got involved with realizing that somehow the Central Intelligence Agency was involved with the murder of John Kennedy, whatever made you think you could take on the federal government?
Right.
Do you know that Jim Garrison was the first man to hire a woman in the United States to work in a district attorney's office? And James Baldwin, who wrote The Fire Next Time, was arrested in his jurisdiction back then, and they were trying to prosecute him. All the right-wingers in New Orleans were trying to get him into jail, and Jim Garrison wouldn't bring the case to trial because he had a First Amendment right. And so I said to him, whatever made you think you could take on the federal government? And Cindy, without batting an eye, he said, John, I guess as a young boy, I saw one too many Frank Capra movies. And you know, Cindy, that was me as a kid. You know,
right.
I came from a severely dysfunctional home long before it was popular. And as a kid, I used to spend most of my time at a place called the Manor Theater in Kingston Road in Toronto, 5 cents in the double feature. And I loved those Frank Capra movies with Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yes,
so that's the American
image
that,
yeah,
that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into the substance of your interviews, which are, I'm so glad they're being told in this film, because what really could be more historical than you know, that interview and what happened in, you know, 1963. But I've been doing the math in my head. I think it might be the 52nd anniversary of the Kennedy assassination.
Well, if it's 2015.
Minus 63 is 52.
Well, it'd be 53rd anniversary, I think. But
He was assassinated in 1963, right?
Yeah, November 22nd. You're absolutely right.
Because I remember I was 6 years old and I'm 58 now, so it had to be 52 years ago.
Okay, well,
anyway.
I was 30, and the interesting thing about this is that my second professional job as a stand-up comic was a famed Hungry Eye in San Francisco, which spawned Mort Saul, who became mm-hmm. Kennedy's favorite, Jonathan Winters, Lenny Bruce, Bill Cosby. And I was booked there the latter part of October and the first part of November. And most of my act was political. My opening line was, you know, my name's John Barber, and I'm being brought to you through the courtesy of the NAACP, and people would giggle, and then I'd say the National Association for the Advancement of Canadian People. I was making observations as a newcomer about America, and a lot of it was political, and a lot of it was about John Kennedy, and I always got huge laughs. I mean, But you remember Von Meter's album called The First Family?
Slightly.
Oh my gosh, if you could Google it. Well, the largest selling comedy album in history was this impressionist, Von Meter, who did the greatest impression of every one of the Kennedys, and it sold millions in about a week. And if you listen to it tonight and now, you'll smile, but it'll almost break your heart because you remember what a vibrant, exciting, lively, intellectual country America seemed to be when John Kennedy was president. As a matter of fact, when he was president, he had a dinner for Nobel Prize winners and poet laureates at the White House. There must have been 20 or 25 of the leading intellectuals and artists in the world there. And John Kennedy said to them at the meeting, "You know, ladies and gentlemen, there hasn't been this much brain power in this room since Thomas Jefferson dined here alive."
Alone.
Alone.
Yeah.
Can you imagine any president since who was intellectual enough or knowledgeable enough, who read enough to be able to say something that brilliant? Anyway, Von Meter, I happened to say to my wife, I said, "Oh, God help us if anything happens to John Kennedy. John's going to be out of a job. Von's going to be out of a job." And of course, Kennedy was killed November 22nd, 1963. And I remember exactly where I was because I had done so well that they had booked me back to open on November 24th, which is 2 days after the assassination. So very honestly, Cindy, I was not concerned about the murder of a president. I didn't know much about politics at that time. I just wrote about it. I was only concerned about my act, and my act was gone, as was Von Meter's. So now I had to write a new act. And when I went back on the 24th, of course, the club was nearly empty.
Right.
The city, excuse the expression, the city was dead. But when I opened 2 weeks later in Fresno, California, there was standing room only, 600 people every night there. And this is while a funeral was going on. It was the first time I had ever encountered so much hatred for John Kennedy. I knew it was out there, but see, I was informed by the media. You know, Mark Twain said years ago, if you do not read the newspapers, you're uninformed. But if you do read American newspapers, you're misinformed. I learned everything by reading the newspapers in the media. So everybody loved John Kennedy, except there was this massive undercurrent of hatred for him that I wasn't aware of until I opened in Fresno.
Well, tell us how... I'm very intrigued by how you funded the documentary. How did that come about?
Oh my gosh. This is absolutely amazing. First, I got to tell you about how I happened to get the 3 hours of interview with Jim Garris. I got real people. I had created real people. It was called at first National Graffiti. I had it for 1 year at ABC. And the reason I called it National Graffiti, there was a great movie called American Graffiti, and then the newspaper National Enquirer. So I combined the two. And I had done an interview in 1978 with Daily Variety and said, "I'm going to change this unknown Canadian. This is going to change the face of American television with what I call the entertainment of reality." So I have this at ABC, and I want my co-host to be Richard Pryor. And I said to the guy's name was Lou Ehrlich, head of programming at that time. And I said, "I want Richard Pryor to be my co-host." And he looked at me and he leaned over the table and he said, "That nigger is never getting on this network." Now, at the time, Richard Pryor was in jail because he'd beat up an NBC executive because they edited something out of one of his specials, and the IRS was trying to put him in jail also because he was not paying his taxes. So he wasn't popular in the community. But I said to him, I said, "This kid puts 10,000 asses in seats in Oakland, and he's going to be a star." So indeed, he became the huge star that he was. Anyway, they passed on it. I had done the revival of Laugh-In. And doing the revival of Laugh-In, I accidentally met George Slaughter. When I was a media critic at NBC, George Slaughter, who was the owner of Laugh-In, he didn't actually create it. An Englishman named Digby Wolfe, a really funny drunk comedy writer, created the title and half the concept for the show, but George Slaughter ended up owning it. And he called me at NBC and asked me if I would let him use some of the jokes that I wrote in my column. And I said, I have a better idea. Let me be your critic at large on the show and I'll write my own stuff. And he said, wonderful, come and do it. So I did it. That's the show that introduced Robin Williams. That's where I met Frank Sinatra, who hired me for 3.5 years to be his writer, to write his special material. Anyway, as a result of getting to know George there, accidentally, I bump into him after ABC passes on the show, and he said, come here and do it. I have a deal for 4 specials at NBC. So I did. I wrote and edited almost every hour in the entirety. We started at the bottom of the heap. NBC was supposed to get the 1980 Olympics, and they lost the Olympics, so they were in the toilet. And Real People was the only show that saved NBC. In 10 months, it was the number one show in America. And for the 2.5 years that I ran the show, we used to get a 50 share in Chicago. That's more than MASH, All in the Family, the largest rated regular show in the history of television, which you never see about. But what happens, Cindy, when somebody owns a show? The networks do not go to the man or the woman who creates it. They didn't come to me. They went to the owner. Well, George Slaughter, who owned and then later destroyed Laugh-In, was sort of like the Jerry Jones of televisions. He owned the stadium and he owned the team, but he didn't know how to play the game. I was a quarterback and I was essentially the team, even though we had a great cast on camera, Sarah Purcell, Skip Stevenson. NBC calls him and asks him, do you remember the movie Network?
Of course.
Okay.
Brilliant.
Absolutely and totally brilliant. And when I was a critic, it came out in 1977, Cindy, I said, folks, this is the only movie in American history made by Hollywood at which you will go just to listen to it, not to look at it. Chayefsky's dialogue is so brilliant, as you say, and it's more pertinent today in
Absolutely.
2015 than it was in 77 when it came out. Anyway, NBC called Slaughter and said, we'd like you to do sort of a takeoff on Network. I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. And so Slaughter agrees to do the show. They hire Marjo Gortner, who had once been a child evangelist, very nice fellow, very bright. And then Herb Brooks became a friend of mine. Herb Brooks was the coach of that wonderful hockey team, Miracle on Ice, that beat the Russians. So he was extremely popular at the time, and Slaughter's a promoter, and he figured it would bring a lot of attention to the show, and a beautiful black lady named Jane Kennedy. So they were the three. Anyway, I had not talked to Mr. Garrison since 1970, when I first tried to book him on my talk show in Los Angeles, when I had accidentally, again accidentally, read Heritage of Stone after he had lost the case. And when I called him to book him, he told me I would never get away with it, but I booked him anyway. And we were bumping heads with the Today Show, Cindy. I won my first of 5 Emmys. 2 weeks after I had booked him, I was fired and he was canceled. The only other time I talked to him, when I was hired at NBC as the critic, I had done a stand-up on one of the variety shows. It might have been Dean Martin's show, and I said that Watergate was an incident that put America on the brink of democracy. So I got this lovely note from Garrison. So I called him and thanked him, and we talked about Vietnam, and then he talked about some of the names in Watergate that he had uncovered while investigating his case back in 1960. He arrested Clay Shaw in 67, and it wasn't until 69 that he got to trial. And I lost a lot of friends. I was not interested in the assassination at all. I was just interested in trying to feed my family. And in any event, what happened is that after I booked him, as I said, he said I would never get away with it. I didn't get away with it. So I don't talk to him. I never met him. Then in 1981, George Slaughter has Speak Up America on. He comes to me all the time because he was a man, and this happens to a lot of successful producers in town. They cannot create anything original on their own, but they're like barnacles that live off of the creative people that know how to do it, okay? Mm-hmm. He did that on a Laugh-In. He did it Real People because it was actually my show. Anyway, Speak Up is dying, and he keeps coming to me, and he said, John, will you help me? And I said, I can't, George. I'm spending 20 hours a day writing and editing these stories. And then accidentally again, Cindy, this is going to be the theme of your show today, accidents.
Okay.
I pick up the LA Times, and page 13, I read about the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and they have found this dictabelt found by a fellow named Gary Mack, who is in the original documentary, The Garrison Tapes, and it reveals that at least four shots were fired. So the House Select Committee concludes there has been a conspiracy to murder John Kennedy. I get on the phone immediately to Garrison and listen to the language that you don't hear Americans talk like this anymore. Gore Vidal talked like that.
Right.
And I hate to say it, even William F. Buckley, the guy funded by the CIA for his television show, he also talked like that. Americans. But when I called him, I said, Mr. Garrison, do you feel vindicated? Cindy, he said, John, I feel like a blind man has gotten a very small trophy in a very dark room, meaning I'm the only one who knows it.
Uh-huh.
So I said, well, you must be swamped with phone calls from Huntley and Brinkley and Cronkite and all Rather and all these people, Jennings. He said, John, nobody's called you. You're the only person who's called me. So I said, well, I'm going to come down there and tell your story. And he said, Cindy, he said, John, I haven't told the story in 10 years. 10 years I haven't told the story. And he said, you know, I lost the Clay Shaw conviction, but I actually won the case. And I said, how do you mean you won the case? And he said, I was really after the perjury conviction because Clay Shaw knew Lee Harvey Oswald. He knew David Ferry. We got pictures of all these people together. And I said, well, what happened? He said, the government stepped in and stopped the prosecution. And of course, Clay Shaw, like many others, mysteriously died. I said, well, I'm going to come down there and I'm going to put you on camera. So I did that, did the interview, went down there. And I had asked two very pertinent questions. The first question was, Mr. Garrison, how many shooters do you think there were? He said, John, there were probably three. It's a military operation that's called triangulation. And in cases like this, they would have a shooter and somebody to pick up the shell. And with triangulation, they probably had somebody at the Daltex building, somebody behind the nasty grassy knoll, and somebody probably up by the bridge. But this is the most important killing of their life. And he said, John, they assassinate all around the world, absolutely and totally all around the world. And I'm going to put this in. He said to me, he said, John, these people had no qualms in Vietnam, dropping napalm on women and children running around in black pajamas who were yellow and watching them burn to death. Do you think they would have any problem eliminating a solitary 5 foot, 9 inch, blue-eyed, red-headed Irish American? Not at all. They're in the killing business, and he was interfering with their thing, with their operations in Vietnam. So he said they would have to have an audio man, a radio man. So there are three teams, three men on a team. That's nine. So the next question I ask him is the obvious question. I thought, I said, Mr. Garrison, how many people do you think actually knew that Kennedy would be murdered in Dallas? And he sort of extrapolated out, well, they have the nine shooters. There are obviously fake Secret Service people all over Dealey Plaza, some very probably prominent people from the military. Edward Lansdale probably wanted to see it in person, his arch enemy getting his head blown off. He said, obviously, there were also CIA assets there from the media to run with the story. You may recall the Church hearings in 70. Frank Church investigated the CIA. They found at the time in the 70s, they had 1,000 paid assets in American media. Time, Life, Saturday Evening Post, the Networks Radio. Now, look at this. It's now 2015, and in spite of what happened in Paris, which we actually know really little about except what our faux media is telling us, how many CIA assets do you think they have infecting every part of American culture? When we were fighting in Vietnam, we sort of had a pseudo-real war, even though we relied into that. But now this is a phony terrorist war. Terrorists, they don't have airplanes, they don't have an army, they don't have a navy. There's no way these people can invade the United States of America, and yet we have this perpetual war machine. So, anyway, he says 32, probably 30 people. 32 people were aware of what was going to happen at the outside. So I come back and I edit them. We have so much material, Cindy, we have to do a two-parter. First part is 8 or 9 minutes. The opening shot. Now, Mr. Garrison has not had a free word to say on American television ever. He did sue NBC when they trapped NBC producer Walter Sheridan. Are you still there?
Yeah. Hello. Oh.
But Walter Sheridan was an FBI CIA asset producer at NBC who went down to New Orleans to try to bribe Perry Raymond Russo, who is Garrison's major witness, to leave, not be a witness against Shaw, and go and get a $50,000 job at an insurance company that they already set up for him. But Perry Raymond Russo turned them down, so Garrison got a half hour late night. He was also on The Tonight Show, but Carson was totally inept when the CIA and the FBI were preparing him with questions. He was totally out of his league and kept interrupting Garrison. So Garrison never really had prime time except on this show. So the first shot is him leaning toward the camera with these huge bulbous eyes and deep, sincere voice saying Lee Harvey Oswald had nothing to do with the assassination of John Kennedy. As a matter of fact, he never fired a shot. Well, the audience gasped. They had never heard this before. They're spellbound. And, oh, my God, the ovation when it's over. So I call Mr. Garrison in New Orleans. He's so pleased. He can't believe I got away with it. So I said, well, I'm doing part two, and it'll be on next week. So what I had done, I had, of course, done the interview. I give Marjo Gortner, who's the guy who's co-hosting a show, 6 questions. One of the questions I give him is, Mr. Garrison, how many shooters do you think they were? And I edit him into the story. So at the time, Cindy, on Real People, I was making $22,000 an hour plus $11,000 for a rerun. So that's $33,000 an hour. I was building a wonderful new home a block from Bob Hope's place to rival Bob's house and rented a small house a block away. My wife and son and I are sitting on the sofa waiting for part two of Speak Up America to come on. It's announced. There's a huge ovation from the audience. Then they get into the story, and Marjo Gortner is on camera, and he's saying, Mr. Garrison, how many shooters do you think there were? They cut to Jim Garrison, and Jim Garrison is seen saying, 32.
Right.
So I look at the screen. And I say, what on earth happened? I mean, I'm stunned. The phone rings, and it's George Slaughter. He said, John, what do you think? And I said, what did you do? What did you do? I edited the story. You defamed that man. And he says, that man is a fraud, John, and he deserves it. He is a kook. And I said, George, I hope he sues your goddamn ass, and I'm going to be his biggest witness. I have recorded this conversation. This is deliberate malice. I slammed the phone down. I called Jim in New Orleans, and Cindy, I'm crying. I can't. I have only cried twice in my entire life. One was at the old movie, Mr. Goodbye, Mr. Chips, with Robert Donat. Sob every time I see it to this day. And I'm crying on the phone. I don't know what happened. Sue him, please, Mr. Garrison. I've recorded this. I will be your chief witness. We can prove deliberate malice. It's libel. And he said, and I can't believe he said this in the calmest voice I ever heard. He said, John, if I spent half of my time in a courtroom defending myself against these people, I would not only never see my family, he said, I'd never see the inside of my office. He said, my family and I just love your show, Real People. Just keep doing that, okay? He said, and forget about it. It would. He said, I know you tried your best. And then what he did, Cindy, he gave me the name of one of the other Oswalds. There were two or three Oswalds who happened to be in prison back east. And he said, you go back there and give him a Real People t-shirt, and he'll probably tell you his side of the story. Anyway, the next day, I confront Schlatter in his office. We almost got in a fist fight. Then I confronted the girl I had hired to be the field producer. Her name was Donna Cantor. She was the daughter of Hal Cantor, the country's greatest joke writer. He was a principal joke writer for the Academy Awards for 25 years and a very good friend of mine. Helped me a lot in the business. So help pay him back, I hired his daughter, Donna. And I confronted her and I said, what happened? She said, George called me at midnight. I said, like a damn vampire? And she said he deliberately edited that way. And I said, why on earth did you not call me? And she said, I was ordered not to. He'd fired me if I called you. So anyway, I knew my days were numbered, and they were certainly numbered. Now, when Leno Sanick came down here July 4th to interview me, asking me to tell the story.
And who is Leno Sanick?
I beg your pardon, dear?
And who, tell my listeners who Leno Sanick is.
Oh, yes. Leno Sanick has the best information internet radio show about the assassination that you can ever hear. It's extremely popular. It comes out of Vancouver. And he had me on, like you did, Cindy, over a year ago. And he was so intrigued by the information, he wanted to have it permanently on film. And again, he called me by accident to come down and do this. And he asked me, he said, well, did Schlatter do this on orders of NBC? And I said, Len, I do not know. And I said, I would have known if Jim had sued him and we could have gotten depositions. But I said, Schlatter never talked politics, but he was very friendly with Nixon and Reagan. And there's a lot more to this story than I can go into. But I will tell you, the second inaugural of George Bush was produced by George Schlatter. So that's all I'll say about that. So naturally, I lost Real People. Now, I have this unbelievable 3 hours and what to do with it. And I didn't know what to do with it. And now you ask me how I happened to make the documentary. It is announced in 1970 that Oliver Stone is going to be making JFK with Kevin Costner. So I call Oliver's office, and I'm still very prominent and sort of still a star. And I can't get through to Oliver Stone. He won't come to the phone. And I tell him, I said, I've got this 3 hours of the real Jim Garrison. Why doesn't Oliver act as executive producer? I'll write and produce and direct it. And a year after his movie is finished and released, he can release this documentary, which reaffirms everything he's talking about. And she said, well, hang on. Well, Oliver never came to the phone. She comes back and she said, send over the tapes. And I said, you send over Oliver. I'm not sending him my tapes, for crying out loud. She hung up. I never heard again from Oliver. But I got a call from Elizabeth Garrison. Jim Garrison's on his deathbed. And Elizabeth is the one who's nursing him. Says, John, do you ever heard of somebody named Rosie from Oliver Stone's office? And I said, no, why? She said, well, this lady calls identifying herself as being from the office and says that it wouldn't be a good idea for Mr. Garrison to get involved with John Barber trying to tell his story. And I said, why? And Rosie said, well, this man doesn't have a good reputation in this town. And I said, what did your father say? She said, my father didn't blink. He said, you helped John. He's the only one from the beginning who tried to help tell the story. So now I've got to put up my house, Cindy.
Uh-huh.
To get the money. Now, when Oliver made Salvador, which is one of the best political movies made in Hollywood, he mortgaged his house. God bless him. He risked everything to tell the story. So I figured, well, I can do the same. I'll sell my house. It's worth nearly $1 million, and I only need a couple of hundred thousand dollars to do the documentary. So I put it up for sale. Now, this is so bizarre. And as I say, I'm not religious or metaphysical, but this is actually what happened. Three young, handsome men come to the door, ring the bell. They want to see the house. Their names are Brunson. They're very famous in Utah as trumpet players, the Brunson brothers. Mm-hmm. And I had been screening my tapes, but I had frozen the picture on the TV set of Jim Garrison with his name under it. They walk in, and what the older brother said, is that Mr. Garrison guy? And I said, yeah. And he said, could we look at this for a minute? So I said, okay. So I played 5 minutes and stopped. I said, that's it. Now I'll show you the house. And they said, well, we don't want to buy the house. We just want to see it, because it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, listen, I'm trying to sell this thing so that I can get the money to do a documentary. And Cindy, they say, you know what, Mr. Barber, we just came from the Hollywood Hills. There's a fellow up there who is looking for houses up in the hills. He is the son of a very wealthy tobacco maker in Virginia, and he wants to get into the movie business, and he's opening up a little company. What if we introduce you to him? Well, I thought, what nonsense is this? So they introduced me to this fellow. His name is Lamar Card, and he started this little business called Blue Ridge Films. He comes over to the house, and I screen the 3 hours for him. He's standing and cheering, and he said, John, this is so important. I have $200,000 for you.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's where the money came from, plus what I did. So I go out, and I do the document, and I'll tell you something. Harold Weisberg is one of the great researchers. He published at his own expense these books called Whitewash. He is hired by Oliver Stone as one of the consultants on the film, but Harold is so perturbed. Now, I'm going to tell you something about these assassination researchers. They are as much a hindrance to finding the truth about who killed John Kennedy as is the CIA, because they're so possessive about their own little bailiwick of information and so egotistical. They're always infighting. Anyway, Harold is upset at Oliver because Oliver isn't paying more attention to him. He takes Oliver's script and it sends it to what they say is a CIA asset at the Washington Post, this guy named Lardner, George Lardner. You may remember the Post decimates Oliver before the film is even made.
Yes.
And I am convinced that Oliver may have changed his story a little bit because there was an enormous amount of heat brought back on him. Anyway, so I do the documentary, and the guy that I had helped me do it was a really nice man named Freddie Weintraub, who discovered Bruce Lee with Enter the Dragon. He was responsible for Woodstock being done by Warner Brothers. And he helped me because he knew the finances and all the rest of about. So we do this wonderful documentary, okay? People are cheering it when we screen it in Santa Monica. And it's an obvious Academy Award winner. And Freddie blows it because originally CNN was going to pay $300 to buy it. And then they backed out. Well, Freddie was so upset, he sold it to Cinemax. Cinemax ran it for only 1 month as an addendum to Stone's JFK, biggest ratings they ever got. They have never rebooked it. No station in America has ever shown that film, even though it's been offered to them free. So what happened is I went to the Lemley Theater, Narhurst Theater here in L.A. and in San Francisco, standing room only. The L.A. Times shows up uninvited, gives it a rave review, but because it was sold first to television, it's disqualified from the Oscars.
Oh,
but
yikes.
It ends up at San Sebastian, wins the San Sebastian Film Festival Award. Werner Herzog, that brilliant German filmmaker and intellectual, hears about it. He flies me into Vienna, gives me an award. I go to it's a huge hit all over the world and cannot be screened or shown in the United States of America, where it matters the most.
Right, exactly.
So now it disappears and it's gone. What I then did is I then went to, since nobody would take it, I went to the 10 leading assassination sites I offered the documentary, the Garrison tapes, free to every one of them for all of their subscribers and gave them the link. Not one of them would take it. So now I'm going to make this observation, Cindy. The only outfit the government has that does their job well is the Central Intelligence Agency. They are totally capable of keeping us in the dark as to their black op operation. If they are in the American media by the thousands, they have infiltrated the assassination sites. And I would say that half of the people running these sites are involved with the Central Intelligence Agency. Okay, now, you know this outfit ARC, which is a very good outfit. They had a fellow named Robert Blakey. Robert Blakey, law professor at Columbia University. The first person that the House Select Committee hired, and the reason they formed the committee is because Geraldo Rivera in 1977 with Dick Gregory goes on late night television and shows the Zapruder film. Hundreds of thousands of people write to Congress, this has to be investigated. Well, the CIA doesn't want that, but they don't do anything right away. Richard Sprague is hired, this tough lawyer out of Philadelphia. He has a staff of six, Cindy, and you know his first words to them, we hire no CIA agents, we hire nobody from the FBI, we have independent investigators, we'll solve this crime and we'll make the CIA bring vanloads of their files to this office. Of course, there are CIA assets in Congress and in the Senate, of course, in the media. They work to get rid of Richard Sprague, which they do. He would have won the, he would have solved the case, or they would have murdered him. And they replace him with G. Robert Blakey. Now, G. Robert Blakey has no choice because of the Mac footage, the dictabelt that sees four shots are fired. So they conclude there's this assassination. What does Blakey do? He publishes a book blaming the mafia. Now, you and I know if Italian had been responsible for the murder of John Kennedy, there wouldn't be a pizza parlor in America. Right. And if you go to the dedication of the book, he dedicates part of it to the Central Intelligence Agency. And this outfit, oh, Art, last week, Art had him as a guest speaker. Joan Mellon, who is the best researcher about the CIA, and Garrison was also in the panel, and I phoned her, and I said, Joan, how can you be on stage with that man? You should be in the audience yelling at him. So anyway, nothing happened. So the 50th anniversary comes along, and I'll try to get to this quickly.
Yes,
25 years ago, there were all kinds of, not all kinds, but a half a dozen stories done by Bill O'Reilly and Geraldo Rivera, sort of questioning the Warren Report, but on the, and they dwindle every year. Now these guys say nothing. And what does O'Reilly do? He publishes a book called Killing Kennedy, Killing Christ. I'll buy one when it says Killing Myself. But anyway, it's such a total sellout and fraud. So what it is that I want to do is I'm going to do something on my own about the 50th anniversary. And I see that Charlie Rose interviews Bobby Kennedy Jr. in Dallas. And Bobby says, my father did not believe that Oswald acted alone. He didn't believe the Warren Report privately, but publicly he had to. So anyway, I have a friend, Dick Russell, who wrote one of the best books, The Man Who Knew Too Much About the Assassination. I said, hey, I'm going to UNLV. I'm going to put on an event. George Knapp has agreed to host the event free because he thinks it's a public service. The university is giving me all their facilities free because they think it's a public service. I want to get Bobby Kennedy out here. Do you know how I go about it? Cindy says he's one of my best friends. We do a lot of stuff together, write stuff together about the environment. So anyway, he contacts Bobby. Bobby says he's interested. He gets $25,000. That's his fee. I negotiate through the Kepler Agency in Virginia. He agrees to do it. And then Dick calls me and says he hasn't seen the documentary. So I send it to him. Now, this is in July and August, so I'm planning months ahead of November. For 2 or 3 months, he doesn't even look at the documentary. And Dick calls me back and he says, John, he hasn't seen it, but he thinks Garrison's a kook. And I yell at him, Jesus Christ, how can he think that? He said, well, that's what he's read. I said, listen, this is Jim Garrison, the only law enforcement officer to investigate this. And I says, and you tell him about my involvement with Thomas Noguchi about his father. Now, here quickly is another one of those bizarre stories, is that the best book about the Bobby Kennedy assassination is RFK Must Die, written by a guy named Blair Kaiser. Blair was a friend of mine. He was afraid for his life. Thomas Noguchi had performed the autopsy on Bobby Kennedy. The autopsy report, which is public, you can get, says a gunshot wound was no more, the muzzle was no more than 2.5 inches from the back of the left rear of the ear of the head because of the extensive powder burns. Well, the CIA, city council, and the cops try for years to get him to alter the autopsy report, and Thomas Noguchi refuses. So they're trying to get rid of him. And so I accidentally become involved with forming a committee to save Thomas Noguchi's job as an independent coroner. Now, get this. Rewind this to when I'm back with Frank Sinatra and doing all his work. And one day I say to him, I say, Francis, that's what he wanted us to call him, if you're a friend. I said, Crosby died. Nobody knows about him. I said, but when you die, they'll be playing your songs in restaurants 100 years from now because you were a social force and political force. If you hadn't done High Hopes with the Rat Pack, John Kennedy might not have gotten to the White House. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to come to your house every weekend for months and months. You're going to go on camera telling your life story. It's going to be like an Italian Roots. It'll be the first visual autobiography of a performer. He grabbed my hand, John. He said, John, that's wonderful. Write it up. How much do you want? I said, I don't want anything. He said, write it up. So I wrote it up, sent it to his secretary, Dorothy, and within days they call, and this is in the Leno Sanic film, they call and say they want to go ahead and start doing it, but I can't, Cindy, because I am doing real people, and I don't have time to do this wonderful thing with Sinatra. So 3 years go by, I lose the job, and now Sinatra's interested. But what happens? Bill Holden dies. He is in his condominium in Santa Monica. He's drunk. He falls down, hits his head on a coffee table, bleeds to death, and the reports in the paper say it's a heart attack. Noguchi performs the autopsy and finds out that he was really drunk, and they bled to death. He was unconscious, and that changed the story of the media. Well, the community of Hollywood is outraged because now they're talking about one of America's cinema idols, Bill Holden. And a committee is formed by Hollywood to get rid of Thomas Noguchi.
Oh, gosh.
And guess who heads up the committee to get rid of Thomas Noguchi? Frank Sinatra. So he and I never, ever speak again. That is lost. So that's how the fickle finger of fate will sometimes reward you metaphysically with $200,000 and then throw it and take it away from you. But you know, it didn't matter to me, actually, because telling Jim's story was more important. Now, so we do it. I do not think anybody can follow the Garrison tapes because it is such a great film. Not because I did it. Well, maybe because I did it. But it turns out you're involved with the investigation of Garrison, but you're also involved with the man. So it becomes literally a real people story. I do. So what I do is I'm going to pay Bobby Jr. my $25,000, but the day before he cancels. Now, I know that Bobby cannot add any information about the CIA. Not at all. But I know if a live Kennedy shows up at this event, we'll sell a million DVDs just from the emotional impact alone, and I will have enough to do part two, which I had started to work on, which is called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. But he cancels the day before. I still have the $25,000 and the facilities. So I say to my wife, do you mind if I spend it and hire Joan Mellon, Dick Russell and Jim Mars, pay all their expenses? I'm sure they never get paid when they go to these things. And so she agrees. I hired them. I never thought anybody could follow the Garrison tapes. But I must tell you, they could take the hour they did following that film. They topped the film. Questions and answers from the audience, which were outstanding. One 18-year-old boy said, I believe the CIA did it. But why would they make it so public? And the reason maybe the Zapruder film was not suppressed is they keep it public as a warning to any president who follows who thinks he is president of the United States and runs the country. He does not. I mean, their answers are so good. They could take it to Broadway or Carnegie Hall and have sold out. I mean, it's just outstanding. So we take the documentary, which is called The Last Word on the Assassination, which indeed it's not, but it was the last word for, because it happened in January. On the 50th, the last word of the 50th, put it up on Amazon. Cindy, Amazon has 500,000 titles.
Uh-huh.
We go up the first day, we're like 283,000. And about 2 weeks later, we're down to like 140,000. In 3 months, we are in the top 15. You can go to Amazon, Google The Last Word on the Assassination, and see nearly 100 unsolicited rave reviews who people who spent the $15 to get this outstanding documentary. I mean, they spend their money and then they have the dedication to go back and reward Jim and me by putting these wonderful things up. So then that's out there only by word of mouth. Today it sells one or two every day. God bless them. So anyway, Leno Sanek calls me, shows up on July 4th. Which is Meyer Lansky's birthday, Monica Lewinsky's birthday, Neil Simon's birthday, and America's birthday.
Uh-huh.
So that's it. And he asked me to tell how I happened to get involved with a Garrison. So I sat there and I told the story and I reminisced and went into a lot more detail than I am here with you because we don't have the time.
Yeah, in fact, we're unfortunately, I can't believe it. We're almost out of time. But so the you have a new one premiering
today.
Yes, today when the show premieres. And so, how can my listeners check that movie out?
It's called John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Tapes. And if you just go to johnbarbersworld.com. Picture will come up on the top of the page. There's a YouTube icon. Click that icon, and the very top film should be John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Tapes. It runs 1 hour and 10 minutes. Even if you are not interested in the murder of John Kennedy, folks, if you are interested in an unbelievably true, informative, kind of exhilarating, real people American story, this is it. This is the story of the guy who tried to tell Mr. Garrison's story. And we've started a GoFundMe campaign and an Indigo campaign to do the part two. And you know what, Cindy? Before it even aired, just when the word got out, people have already sent in donations.
Oh, well, you know, John Barber's world is a wonderful world. And I'm glad to just be a little part of your world. And I'm just very excited that this show, like we were talking about before we started recording, just will serendipitously premiere on the day that the movie premieres on the 52nd anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And I don't know if you know this, John, but my son Casey, who was killed in Iraq, was born on May 29th, which is John F. Kennedy's birthday.
Oh, my goodness.
And he was assassinated, and then Casey was killed on April 4th, after, you know, the same day that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. So,
oh my gosh, that is so, so sad, Cindy.
Yeah.
And you know, you, I always refer to you as America's Lady of Liberty. I mean, you're a treasure, honest to goodness, you know. And Garrison always said, you know, even if just one person has the truth, one person with the truth is a majority over any army.
Well, and I had an extensive meeting with Senator Ted Kennedy. Well, he was still, you know, he was still a senator. He was still working in Washington, D.C. His illness hadn't progressed or anything. He was still really articulate and there mentally. And no matter, you know, the Kennedys have this, like, sketchy history here. And you know, I said, besides all that, Senator, your mother had to bury so many children. And I don't care if her name is Rose Kennedy or, you know, Cindy Sheehan or, you know, Miriam in Palestine or Amelia in Iraq. A mother should never bury their children.
No, they should not. No, they should not.
And so we, you know, that's something that I, you know, there's of course some mothers who shouldn't be mothers, but that's something that that we all share. You know, we share that link of love, and that's the link that we need to exploit to end these wars, to end the black ops of the CIA.
You know why it won't happen, Cindy? The reason it won't happen, and I hate to say this, because good people don't have the courage to kill the bad people. They just don't, and they deserve. You know,
I don't know if it's the courage that's lacking. It's,
well, you know, George Bush,
we're instilled with some kind of backwards moral code that we have to follow, but they don't.
That's right. Well, George Bush Sr. said, for crying out loud, if the public really knew what we were doing, they'd hang us. Well, it's true.
Yep.
Absolutely and totally true. But there's something else that I will tell you that I told my audience the other day on my radio show. If you face the fact of all of history, all important changes and improvements to society, whether it's in religion or politics or art or music or literature or anything, it's all done by the black sheep in that particular society, from Galileo to Snowden. And I said, you know, that Thomas Jefferson and George Washington had fewer than 5% of the American population at the time supporting them.
Yep.
Castro only had 12 people in a rowboat.
Yep, absolutely.
And Jesus only had the dirty dozen Christians, for crying out loud, okay? And so, but what happens is the majority, the white sheep, allow themselves to be controlled by one shepherd and a goddamn dog.
That's about it in a nutshell.
And there's no way you can change that. You know, we have had two or three of the debates here in Las Vegas, and I said, and I watched them all because I'm forced to, because if I'm going to comment on them, I have to watch them. I only hope that commercial is true, Cindy, that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. None of these people should get to Washington.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, I love and adore you.
Oh, and likewise. And thank you for giving your time again, John. And it's just wonderful to talk to you.
You too, love. And keep playing Victor Moan's song. Okay?
Awesome. Will do.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's the soapbox for this week. I really hope you go to John Barber's World and check out the new documentary called John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Tapes. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank John Barber for being on the show today. And as always, I'd like to especially thank you for listening to and supporting Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.